Well, there's been an election, there's been an independence majority elected, there's been a mandate for a second independence referendum. But because of that one seat short of a working majority, the Conservatives are trying to style the SNP's election victory as somehow a fail. We discussed this in a very late night podcast and hope you enjoy the analysis. And the look at what's been happening south of the border and the fate of Labour in England. Those are the headlines. Now for the podcast.
Hi, Johnson. Welcome to this week's Leslie Riddick podcast, one that we've delayed from Thursday because of the Scottish elections. And we're sitting here in the twilight zone as evening fogs, and we're doing night fogs actually, and we're doing something we swore we'd never do, yes. Which is record at night. And it was quite an odd one because usually you start off in darkness waiting overnight and you're getting all the results coming in and then you wake up in the light. This has been the absolute reverse of that, because it started off this morning at around about 9 o'clock, and even before that listening to the news on the radio, and here we are as night falls. And
I just thought we should just cut to the chase in case anyone's going, oh, yeah. You know, what is it? Yes. So
yeah. SNP 64, which is one up, but one short of the mythical overall majority narrative that we're going to be talking about. Conservatives, 31. I don't think there's any change there. Labour, 22, who are down. Greens, 8, they've gone up. And Lib Dems, down to 4, which is a significant number when we talk about the Lib Dems. Big news is the turnout. Absolutely unbelievable. I mean, against all expectations, where people were saying, you know, it's COVID and people won't get out to vote. And nobody's really, and it's up verging on Westminster levels. It's a record turnout in the Scottish elections. Utterly amazing.
Yeah. And kind of, well, I mean, we're just literally the final piece of the jigsaw just got announced about kind of 10 minutes ago. And it produced this tantalising final list seat in south of Scotland that wasn't totally expected for Emma Harper, which gave the SNP 64. And it's like the classic Scottish result, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, to have got 63, well, all right, you know, but one short of the 65, it's just having a laugh. You know, it's like fate having a laugh. But of course, the difficulty is that, you know, I've spent the day getting extremely exercised, having, well, not the day, but because I've not been watching the TV as much as Pat. He's going to give you his election campaign in a minute. Mine's been sort of duking backwards and forwards, doing bits and bobs of sort of broadcasting and writing things. So happily, I've been spared some of the more irritating contributions. And I haven't, for example, had more than one engagement with Ramsay Jones, which was really quite an enjoyable one on my part, after which he seemed to just take up residence in the BBC the whole of yesterday. But the thing is that what's been running on the BBC and Sky straplines all afternoon is, you know, this is the same story, that the SNP are short of a majority. That was the BBC's line. The Sky News line most of today: Nicola Sturgeon's hopes of winning a majority uncertain. Now, this has been driving me crazy because, you know, obviously in one sense that's true, but it's kind of, the words are cast in the way of, essentially, this is looking at a proportional Scottish system through a British electoral prism. Because, I mean, that we all know this, that managing to kind of break the bank was extremely unlikely. Now, the thing is, two things. One is that Welsh Labour have done that. They have won 30 of the 60 Senedd seats. But actually, just to be annoyingly technical, that is actually one short of an overall majority. But because the presiding officer that will have to be supplied by an opposition party doesn't vote, essentially, Labour will not lose a budget or face a no confidence vote. So essentially, they're in charge. But, you know, in the nitpicking ways of these headlines are cast, they haven't actually totally won an overall majority, just to be pernickety. The other thing would be that the Welsh Labour have not faced tactical voting by three nationalist parties. That's the main difference. In a sense, the Welsh election is as kind of sweetly innocent, I'm speaking in very broad brush terms here, as elections used to be, when people voted for, roughly speaking, the folk they wanted to see in office, not the extraordinary tactical voting that's been going on. According to Sir John Curtis, this isn't being made up by evil, you know, independent supporters. He's reporting the extent. You can see it in the jumps in the seats, you know, where you see some massive jump in a Tory vote. You see an exactly commensurate drop in a Labour vote and vice versa. So this has not happened in Wales. There are not three independence parties facing up to Welsh Labour. That's not the way that it's worked. And the real irony there is that the election that the Welsh have had today most closely resembles 2011 in Scotland.
Absolutely.
Which was before the unionists were sort of aware of the strength of the SNP. No one expected really the SNP to actually win, never mind break the bank to the extent that it did. But that set all the alarm bells ringing, so that they were never, ever going to get the chance again to, you know, to have that level of a run at a Scottish election. And when people talk about, you know, sort of once in a generation, that was a once in a generation election, because I don't think any party will ever be able to break the bank like that in Scotland again, simply because of the level of equal polarisation that exists here on the constitutional question. And it doesn't exist in Wales to the same degree, and won't unless there's a couple of more independence parties set up. So, you know, there's really big differences between the Scottish and kind of Welsh scenarios, which are, you know, worth noting. And then, of course, in the end, the other thing is just what people regard in most normal parliaments and democracies in the developed world. They are proportional. And nobody wins an outright majority. I had a little scutter about to look at, for example, you know, Europe's most powerful woman still, until she demits office, Angela Merkel. Her ruling CDU party has 200 out of 700 seats in the German Bundestag. That's 28% of the seats. But she's the largest party, and nobody questions her right to govern. Emmanuel Macron, En Marche, has got a healthier majority. It's got 280 seats out of 577. That's 48% roughly. Nicola Sturgeon's SNP today has 64 out of 129. That's 49.75% of the seats. Right. Boris Johnson's 80-seat majority that he won, I was going to say stole, but let's just keep calm here, in 2019, that 80-seat majority was won on 43.6% of the vote. Just to recap, it's a lot of numbers here. Today, SNP, let's just call it rounded up, 50% of the seats, right? And what we had for the 80-seat majority that Boris Johnson won was won on 43.6% of the vote. So, you know, that's quite a sort of big difference. And that big majority that Boris won was actually the highest percentage of the vote of any party in a Westminster election since 1979. Now, I'm aware as I'm speaking that I'm jumping between seats and percentages, but the point still remains that the amount of seats you get for your, you know, the bang you get for your buck in a Westminster election is out of all proportion to what you can possibly win in a fair proportional system like Scotland's. So, you know, if anybody basically thinks, you know, that managing to try and pull one over the Scots by describing the SNP's victory as essentially a loss, if anybody thinks that's going to win here, that is just completely and utterly wrong. You know, there's a independence majority. It's actually the biggest that there's ever been in the history of the Scottish Parliament. Hopefully there'll be a little bit more collaboration going on as a result, which would be nice. And, you know, none of this is a reflection of the weaknesses of the SNP. The story tonight is that the SNP have seen off the Tories. They have actually seen off ALBA as well. And they are in a very, very strong position, but one where they are now going to be forced to produce an independence referendum in this parliament.
Yeah, absolutely, Leslie. I mean, I'm just ticking off the points that I was thinking as I was watching the whole thing unfolding today. A couple of things. The first one I'm going to begin with is that what you've actually talked about tactical voting is extremely significant, because what the Tories and, more importantly, Labour unionists have got is an absolute free hit. If you're a Labour unionist, you can vote for the Tories, sure and safe in the certainty there will not be a Conservative government in Scotland. You will have an SNP government, which on by and large will enact progressive policies, you know, economically and socially, that you could probably sign up to, you know. So it's a free hit. You can vote unionist in the knowledge that you won't get a Tory government. And Tories, well, you know, we're not going to get the Tory government, so we can vote Labour purely on the basis of keeping the SNP out. So it's a very negative set of things, which has no impact whatsoever on how Scotland is governed. Because we said right throughout this campaign, as Anna Sarwar and Douglas Ross and, God love them, Willie Rennie, we'll talk about the Lib Dems, they knew, Anna Sarwar and Douglas Ross, there was no pretense that they were going to be the government. So it's an absolute free hit based entirely, the campaign that Douglas Ross ran in particular, emphasised continually that it was all about stopping the independence movement through stopping the SNP. And they failed miserably in that. Mm. And what you've also got is the narrative that's been promulgated by, Christine Jarden for the Lib Dems, Murdo Fraser and Oliver Mundell for the Tories was, don't look at the number of MSPs, look at the numbers. Look at who voted what. And they've turned, as they said, it's a referendum and it's 50-50. And we've all just got to get concentrating on, yeah, pulling together to get ourselves out of the mess that we're in post-COVID. And Boris Johnson sent that letter to Nicola Sturgeon saying, why can't we all work together? We're going to have a summit meeting of the four leaders. We'll wait to find who that First Minister is going to be in Northern Ireland. These narratives that are floating around it, it was the SNP. And again, what happened as well is Richard Finlay, I believe, ex-investigative journalist who won a list seat for the Tories, turned around and said that the SNP were arrogant in their assumption that they were going to gain an overall majority. I do not recall, and you may put me right on this, Leslie, I don't recall anybody in the SNP talking about going for an overall majority. At all.
Well, you see, I was thinking about this and I was thinking that it is, I don't, you know, well, I mean, I can't remember what I did yesterday, but yeah. I think the thing might have been that Nicola Sturgeon, I mean, like any political leader is talking about, and during an election campaign, talks about only the future of their own party.
Yes.
Even in all these other countries as well, you know, even if the likely end destination is some form of pact, coalition or something else, which is not happening here even. But, you know, they're not thinking about an Indy majority, especially in this election,
no.
Because that strayed you into the territory occupied by a rival party, ALBA. So I think it's probably true that Nicola Sturgeon didn't talk much. I don't really remember her talking about an independence majority as an aim. So, you know, however, this would be kind of to be naive. No political party talks about any outcome, as, you know, other than their own party winning as well as they can as an aim. But that doesn't sort of undermine what they eventually arrange, you know. So none of this makes any sense. And perhaps we're all, you know, perhaps we're all just responding too over-vigorously to the predictable snash that basically comes. I mean, I can't remember, there's been a whole flood of blooming columns and stuff, and I can't remember which one I wrote this one for, but, you know, the one that was sort of observing what eventually happened, actually, that despite the fact that Anas Sarwar, as you rightly named him, the Kumbaya candidate, was making a very good name for himself personally, and polling eventually suggested was the second most popular leader in Scotland, actually, the Labour Party itself had sort of plummeted, because people who are very anxious about maintaining the union don't want a nice guy in charge.
Yeah.
They want a real hard man that's completely, you know, there's just quite obviously on send, not receive, and can only stand in a sort of Dalek-like manner, repeating the same thing over and over and over again. that's the kind of guy you want up front, because you perceive the nationalist threat as being so strong. You don't want someone who might actually sit down and talk to, you know, the others. I'm not suggesting Anna Sarwar is a pushover or about to change his position, although it would be a blooming good move for him to start considering something like that now, actually, because, you know, where we are, there is an independence majority. He has been outflanked and outmaneuvered by the Tories again, because all the tactical voting that Labour supporters have done has only put Douglas Ross into the leader of the opposition's chair. So if they actually don't want to sit for the next 4 or 5 years kind of twiddling their thumbs as the also-rans, you know, nice guys, but whatever, bit of a punch up with kind of Willie Rennie, perhaps, for the sort of, you know, well-meaning nice guy slot. If they want to be actual players in all of this, Anna Sarwar, OK, he would have to be eating his words, but he could come out and support the idea of the mandate given, support that an indie ref has to happen in the timescale that Nicola is kind of looking for, and then get in to assume the mantle of the leader of the No campaign in it.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, that would be a sensible thing to do. Mm.
The other thing I thought that Anna Sarwar, given the statements that he made during campaign, might be that he would abandon the Bain principle, which is the Labour Party will fundamentally oppose any policy the SNP puts forward, despite it be possibly being progressive. Will he abandon that and turn and say, well, I'm going to examine policy by policy what the SNP, with the support of the Greens, is going to do, and might actually start voting for policies the SNP produces? And that would be an interesting shift.
Before you move on there, that, I think, there are, you know, again, we might be just hyper-watching too many small things, but there was that extremely entertaining and kind of significant video on the eve, on the election day, actually, when the right-winger Jada Franson turned up with her posse to try and kind of discombobulate Nicola Sturgeon. And bizarrely, actually, filmed this exchange and then posted it in the belief that they won, which was sort of like really baffling, actually, when quite obviously Nicola Sturgeon was clearly heard to say, you're a racist, you're a fascist, and the people of Glasgow will reject you. Now, you know, that got major traction at the kind of, you know, 6 or 7 o'clock at voting time, which, you know, was probably still a lot of people, you know, running out at after work or 7 o'clock. And two very interesting tweets came out of that. One was Owen Jones from the Labour Party, who came straight in and said, you know, fair play and thank you, you know, well done for calling that out. The other was from Anna Sarwar.
Yeah.
You know, saying the same thing. Now, that's smart from his point of view, because, you know, that does distinguish. There's no way Douglas Ross wouldn't even, you know, thank a blooming lollipop lady for taking him over the road when he was 7. You know, it's not in him to be thankful to anybody or to give quarter to what's perceived as an enemy. Whereas Anna Sarwar, you know, is saying, look, this is the kind of behaviour we want here. And that's a good thing. Now, that's a smart thing for him to do. But, you know, this will just be steamrolled over if the great divide in Scotland continues to be the constitutional divide, because people will like him and then vote for Douglas Ross.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, they want the hard men out there. They want this just say no guys. They want this sort of Scottish version of the Ulster unionists. You know, defensive unionism is not a pretty sight. And in Northern Ireland and Scotland, people are electing ever more socially extreme and conservative unionists. So, you know, Anna Sarwar is stuck in a kind of no-go zone. There's nothing in it for him to stay there with Labour. And of course, I guess we're going on to speak to where the mothership is also bobbing about at some point.
Yeah, at some point. Yeah, because the other aspect of it was that the electorate, damn them, decided what the issue was. They decided that the issue was the constitution, and the unionist voters were the one who clearly displayed that was the issue. So despite what Anna Sarwar and Willie Rennie said, that it's all about recovery and we've got to get down to it, people actually took the perspective of the SNP in the main and the Tories, which was, this was an election that was based around the constitutional arrangement, and half of the population reckon that you can't have a proper recovery from COVID, which is a proper national recovery in terms of the kind of vision we want to have for Scotland. And think about that one as well, a vision of an independent Scotland, what it could be, unless we actually have independence. The other bit about it is that the answer that was never given by any politician from any other political party, which was, if there is a pro-independence majority in the Scottish Parliament using the electoral system that we have, which we now have, what is the route if Boris Johnson says no to an independence referendum? What is the route to this? Is there one? And what's been clearly stated is that if it's Section 30 order is denied, that Boris Johnson will take this to the Supreme Court if a referendum bill is passed through legislation in the Scottish Parliament. The Scottish Parliament, not by the Scottish government, the Scottish Parliament will be set up in complete opposition to the UK government. And that is a union that is being enforced by the law, not a union of consent. And I think if Boris Johnson's got any sense, and I don't know if he does, he's in a very, very difficult position, as is Nicola Sturgeon, we can talk about as well, in a very difficult position to actually turn around and have that muscular unionism, because that can drive undecideds who turn around and say, that's our parliament being told no. Not the SNP, not the Greens, that's our parliament. And we've been told no. And Scots do not respond very well to that.
Yes, I mean, you could say it is kind of horses for courses, because the very, I mean, this does seem ridiculous, but muscularity that Douglas Ross sort of exhibits towards any kind of a pro-independence mm-hmm. speaker is kind of obviously hugely attractive to people who are quite worried about, you know, the ever increasing voting and the demographic shift that suggests the longer that we wait, the more younger voters are coming onto the electoral roll who are far more pro-independence. You know, again, the similarity with Northern Ireland striking. But it's incredibly off-putting to yesers. I think the thing is that can... If we're sort of too caught up in our own feelings about it, we just can't mm-hmm. understand why anybody would vote yes. for Douglas Ross.
Yes.
And actually, you've got to get outside your own sort of head to see why people do the things they do. You could also say, I don't know, I still find the lack of support for ALBA actually quite baffling. As we sort of have discussed before, mm-hmm. it wasn't something that initially sort of floated my boat completely, and I have had pelters for that, and that's fine. But I'm still puzzled, you know, because so many people I know were automatically, you know, very mm-hmm. kind of up for it. And it does make you wonder if there's some sort of bubble thing on at work again, where, you know, the few people you know, you sort of tend to extrapolate then, think that there must be far more that feel the same. And yet it just seemed that many didn't. And it could be because the same sort of muscularity was in evidence, in a sense, with Alex, who wanted to, you know, shift the game on, who wanted to push things on a wee bit. And in the end, I know everybody will have their different theories on this, but to me, if we just set the whole thing about Alex Salmond and himself personally aside, I just still have this feeling that what comes out of this is a lot of very strong personal support. You can say it's misguided, mm-hmm. you can say anything you want about it, but it's an election, right? So, you know, this is real. A lot of personal support for Nicola Sturgeon and the one singer, one song approach she has to life.
Yeah.
It annoys the hell out of me, but, mm-hmm. you know, it's as if people want one person driving the car. They do not want someone in the front seat trying to grab the wheel when the driver's not looking, even if he was Stirling Moss in a previous incarnation. So yeah. Somewhere there, you know, the muscularity can work for Douglas Ross with his unionist supporters because they're defensive. But when you're in an aspirational state, which is what the independence movement is, I don't know that the muscular thing works. And it could also be, to be honest, that, you know, polling suggests there are quite a number of independent supporters who are pro-independence, but a bit worried about doing it kind of, you know, within the next 6 months or a year. Mm-hmm. And it's quite possible that they actually are nervous about the idea of bringing things on quicker than they themselves are even comfortable with. But there's got to be a variety of explanations in there, because that was a really, you know, incredibly poor result for ALBA. And I feel so sorry for people who've poured their heart into this.
Yes.
Because they have, you know, it hasn't been a sort of small thing to do what people have done here. And there's a huge amount of effort gone into it. And people will feel very bitter and hard done by, absolutely. And yet, you know, a lot of the stuff that Alex was bringing up, the kind of ideas he'd got about the things that need to be done, the checklist, it's almost like, you know, somebody's going on holiday and there's one guy standing with a checklist that's pretty exhaustive and you wouldn't even forget your toothbrush. And there's somebody else going on holiday that sort of hasn't got their passport, you know, restamped. So the list that Alex was coming up with is absolutely the kind of stuff that has to be gone through. And yet it just didn't. It wasn't enough.
I think it was too late as well. And it just seemed like opportunism. You know, I that's another aspect of it, that people, and people I spoke to are pro-yes and could look at the policies and say, yeah, that's fine. I like that. Chancer. And that's that. It's they were questioning the motivation, not of those who supported the Alba Party or those who were involved in it, but they were questioning the leader of Alba. And it was a very perceived as a very personal project. I mean, what I would like to get your opinion on, though, is that Alba didn't win seats, but I think they pushed independence to the fore, both for the Greens and the SNP. And what they also did, and I think it benefited the Greens, was shone a light on strategic use of your list vote. So paradoxically, mm-hmm. I think that they did the Greens a favour. And also it was being argued, and they actually got more people to go out and vote SNP1 than might have done, who were, you know, even maybe it was 1,000 or 2,000 people who were questioning whether they were going to vote, turned out to vote. And as for people complaining about the SNP seeing voting SNP1-2, I think strategically, if you were looking to have a supermajority pro-independence, SNP1-2 obviously didn't work in the vast majority of areas, as we can see, but it's what the SNP actually had to say. Because as a leader of a political party, you don't turn around people, you're not a leader of the movement, even though de facto you are, but you're a leader of a political party and you want people to vote for your party. But looking about backseat driver, the Greens, what do you think their role is going to be in this? I was interested to note that, and it was Lorna Slater and Alison Johnson both got elected in Lothian, and Lorna Slater was a brand new and added one more to the Greens. I'll be intrigued to see how that dynamic actually works within Holyrood, and I'll be intrigued to see what relationship the SNP builds up with the Greens. Will it be confidence in supply, which is, yeah, we won't vote against you in a vote of confidence, and we'll agree to vote with you on a budget, or will the SNP plough the furrow, as they've done in the past, and ask for support on certain issues, more particularly the budget, or will the SNP reach out and strategically think to themselves, well, guess what, let's get these guys inside so we can, you know, do what the Labour Party did with the Lib Dems back in the day, get them on side, get them involved, get them in government, and keep them closer.
Mm-hmm. Well, just before we go on to the Greens thing, I mm-hmm. think the thing still is that there are two different conceptions about what represented success in this election for the independence parties. One was essentially a working majority for the SNP. You know, we said this right back, mm-hmm. you know, when the Alba started. One, and that's obviously the SNP's conception, but it's also the conception we're sitting watching tonight, how that's the conception that a lot of the rest of the British media have, which they reflect back into Scotland. So, you know, they are sitting with this very fixed idea of what constitutes success. It's not at all clear that Alba have, or indeed the Greens, or perhaps more the Greens, in some way sort of robbed the SNP of a list seat. That's not at all clear.
Mm-hmm.
But from the beginning, if you had worries, people would worry that there would just be one of these blooming ickety things where it would be a little bit of competition from the small parties that would rob the SNP of some seat. And then the simple majority thing would go. And then the Tories would go, see if you'd actually reproduced 2011 somehow. We might have thought about it, but, you know, now that you didn't, it's just as good as a mile. Sorry, no can do, which is kind of what they're coming out a wee bit with now.
Mm-hmm.
Versus the supermajority which people assumed you would want because the Scots are huge on more is more. I mean, Jesus, if there was a kind of national slogan, it would be more is more. We think that about everything from drink to food to just, you know, if something's good, more of it's good. So the supermajority line is very much the same. Why wouldn't you want more, you know, independence MPs, MSPs? But the answer might be that the electorate was really torn between the supermajority logic and the simple majority logic. Mm-hmm. So anyway, here we are betwixt and between with an independence majority that might not be a supermajority in Alex Salmond's version of it, and yet is not quite a, you know, simple working majority either. And yet it's the lion's share. You know, there's an independence mm-hmm. majority in the blinking Scottish Parliament, and it's the biggest there's ever been, kind of, you know, the end. And with the Greens, well, you know, I've kind of done quite a lot of gigs and stuff with Lorna Slater and bumped into her early on and kind of encouraged her actually to do an awful lot more events, especially in Edinburgh where she lives. And she's duly turned up and actually done. I did point out to her that at that point, the Greens were being seen as kind of fairly kind of flaky on the independence front. And it would just be a pretty good idea if someone who actually believed in independence turned up at stuff, you know. So she duly did and has kind of really learnt on the job incredibly quickly. So I think I don't know if you saw, did you see the Scott Squad thing?
No, I didn't. No,
God,
I
was so serious. It was hilarious.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know how many people watched it, but, you know, it's another of these things where, you know, when you come to actually everybody being really quite comfortable in their skin, relaxed and funny, which is also a great tribute to, you know, the actor that plays the kind of chief constable, mm-hmm. I've forgotten his name, Mickelson. But it's a great tribute to the comedy unit, you know, the comedy unit have actually produced a kind of more insightful, incisive event, you know, examination of the personalities of these leaders in some respects than the actual political side of it. But in that anyway, there were some very funny sort of contributions by Lorna Slater. You really have to watch it, Pat. It was a good one to see now.
Right.
So
yeah.
I think, you know, there was a point where she was basically asked, well, if there's going to be a coalition between the Greens and the SNP, you couldn't really have both of yous in there, you and Patrick, you know, because that would be, you know, crowding it out. So who would, you know, who would be the one that would be working with Nicola? So Lorna kind of said, well, I think I could take Patrick. So there was some chuckling about that because she had actually just revealed that she is an acrobat and does high trapeze stuff, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, of course, your mind starts boggling about the sort of, you know, trapeze flipping around Lorna Slater, you know, who just seems, you know, extremely confident and competent at all things, working with a Nicola Sturgeon, who's a fairly sort of, you know, confident, resurgent woman. And just for a small second, my mind was thinking, wow, that is some potent combination. Only for a second, because Nicola doesn't do collaboration, sadly. And I don't see that changing. And also, I think the Greens are tremendously conscious of not being eaten alive by a Leviathan like the SNP. I would say Patrick is also not terribly collaborative, actually. So I think anybody, and I have just put a tweet out with some pious hopes about SNP-Green collaboration, but I don't think we're going to see any. From, you know, there'll be some fronting up, I think.
Yeah.
But in terms of trust and kind of letting go of complete control, why would Nicola Sturgeon, who's just had, you know, a mind-blowing result, why would she, really? Unless she decides that it kind of helps. For any kind of reason, it helps. And I guess the reason would be that the logic is now the Indy majority, not the SNP majority, because that brings you into this confusion about what a majority actually means.
Mm.
I hope people are listening that are still with this. We could be talking utter
shite. I just realised that.
10 o'clock at night.
Yeah, I talked some bollocks at the beginning about not talking about an SNP majority. Of course they talked about an SNP majority. I meant to say they weren't being arrogant about it and there was no presumption of it. So if you've listened thus far, I'm not going to edit that bit out. But that's just a little explanation of what a load of nonsense I was talking. Lib Dems. down to 4, significant, because if you go beneath 5, you're no longer considered a major party in Holyrood terms. You don't go on committees, and you don't get involved in the business of the parliament. Bit of a disaster. They've moved to the fringes of the fringes. I mean, in North East Fife, where both you and I live, and I believe we both had doorstep conversations with Willie Rennie. Very nice ones. Mine was terrible, genuinely enjoyable for about 5 or 6, 7 minutes. We chatted away, and he knew very quickly that I would be voting SNP. And I wouldn't be voting for the Lib Dems either in at constituency level or on the regional list. And it was lovely. And he asked to be reminded to you. I mean, so it was all grand. But, you know, they're the fringe of the fringe now, the Lib Dems, because they've been squeezed out all over the place. And I noticed up in Shetland, for example, which was been a bastion, Tom Wills got within 806 votes.
That's extraordinary. That really is amazing.
That's down from 5,000.
It's so significant. And of course,
Most of the SNP, by the way, I should add.
Yeah. With a succession of kind of big hitters of the Lib Dems kind of departing the scene, from Jim Wallace and then Tavish Scott, it's now Beatrice Wishart, who's not had a huge sort of impact on the parliament, although for a lot of Shetlanders that wouldn't matter too much because they're not keen on Holyrood. But still, you know, Tom is a tremendous, I mean, he's just a bundle of intelligent energy, he is. He works for Nova Innovation, which is a really excellent marine energy company who've installed the first marine kind of tidal array north of Shetland in the world. I mean, lots of people have put in single turbines, but there hasn't been an array that actually produces energy, which is what they've done. The awful possibility is that they might actually, the company's being now feted from different countries with much, much more tasty subsidy regimes than Britain, that still controls energy and is forcing marine energy to compete with mature technologies like offshore and onshore wind for project cash. So, you know, the only reason that company's still here is because they are real believers in Scotland. Mm-hmm. And obviously that's Tom's employer. So, you know, I hope they'll all still be here because, you know, we've got the best possibility of big, big, you know, seismic change in all of our lives, those guys, Tom Wills and obviously all the rest of us. But it's a tremendous the thing is, Tom sort of embodies the future because Shetland's been all about oil, but they're not stupid people. They know it's got to be all about renewables in the future. And he is that, I was going to say lad, which is so blooming patronising, but, you know, he is that man. So I think he's really looking with a very strong chance in the next election, which is mind blowing, you know. And he's also got to do something and see some results about the issues. I know the Shetlanders are really exercised about, having chaired a kind of hustings thing for them a while ago that I think we talked about, that had, you know, speakers on from the Isle of Man and various places, because they want more control. And it's a blimmin' reproduction of the argument we're having here. The more everyone's going, no, you don't get to talk about that. Just. The more people are getting hacked off and then getting more and more extreme scenarios out of it. And it's perfectly reasonable that somewhere like Shetland, and in fact, all local areas need an awful lot more local control. But sadly, the man who would have been the great man to put that arguments forward has not been elected, and that's Andy Whiteman in the Highlands and Islands, who got just over 3,000 votes. That was really disappointing, because I know he was hoping for more than that. But I suspect, from speaking to other people who were really supporting Andy and doing their darndest to try and help him, what they were finding was that people were saying, well, he would be my second choice for sure, but in a situation like this, they were looking at that and either thinking they had to hang on and give, you know, the SNP their vote in the hope that on the list they would get, you know, an extra candidate out of it, or they were going to vote Green to make sure that a Green got elected, which indeed happened. So this is the problem when you're trying to insert yourself into a situation. It's very much the same as Anna Sarwar. You know, I'm sure far more people would like to stand and have a pint with Anna Sarwar than blooming Douglas Ross.
A glass of orange juice, though.
Yeah, right. Well, they didn't vote
for him. A metaphorical one, yeah.
And, you know, far more people, I think, would have preferred to see Andy Whiteman in. But you know, when it came to the options available for them, they didn't want to split the vote.
Yeah.
And that's what's always, I've thought, I have to say, from when... You know, when I had a bit of rush of blood to the head at a really shite SNP conference and said, I'm never coming back to speak here again because you know what to do and you won't do anything about it, you know, on land reform and local power and all this stuff. But there's no point in thinking of setting up new parties until we've got independence because everyone's locked and loaded. There's no room, you know.
Yeah.
And you think it won't apply to you. It does apply to you. It applies to blooming everybody. There's nobody bigger than this divide.
Yeah, it's the Constitution, stupid, to paraphrase Bill Clinton's campaign managers. But the thing I'm going to say, the Parliament is looking very, very interesting. I mean, I'm pleased to see somebody like Paul Sweeney coming back, Labour MSP. Yeah. I think Paul's full of very, very interesting ideas. I think there's going to be a lot of... I've got a lot of time for Michael Marra as well, despite the fact that he was putting out the narrative. It's incumbents that won it, which is, I think, slightly naive. But I think he'll be very interesting as well. And it's a much better gender split as well. I think you're up to women are up to about 46% of the MSPs now. We've got the first two women of colour elected, one SNP and one Conservative. The first person who's a permanent wheelchair user elected, Labour MSP. It's beginning to look a bit more like Scotland, you know. It's beginning to look that way. And I say, I'm genuinely intrigued if it will be a parliament of ideas. And that's been mooted. I mean, what can there? You know, it's late at night and it's been a long day and we're all hopeful with the new MSPs and we will hope it won't go back to, you know, tribalism in that sense. And that ideas can be cross-fertilised across party. And even though the Constitution is the issue on which all will founder, that these ideas can be worked across in terms of the policies we can put in place now within the devolution settlement. But fingers crossed on that one.
It struck me as well how many people, I mean, other people like Jim Fairley, for example, Perthshire South. Now, I mean, that's a great example of that constituency association having the kind of wit and I would say also the gumption actually to not choose some of the candidates that were on offer, you know, included some HQ kind of recommended folk who were not anywhere near the kind of credibility that Jim Fairley and his whole family have got. Yeah. I mean, the Fairleys are just, you know, fairly kind of. I used to live over near Creef, and you know they've got an amazing reputation as a family. And then Jim, as a farmer, this is a great thing to have a farmer who's not a blooming Tory.
Yes.
You know, when you're going around rural areas here, you begin to think the fields have got a mind of their own, and sadly that mind is Conservative and Unionist because you rarely see anything else. So it's incredibly important to have an articulate, remain voting, progressive farmer to represent a farming, largely, constituency.
Yeah.
And that was a tremendous choice by that local organisation. I think some of the disappointments that we've seen around the place, I don't know because I've not been in the innards of all those selection procedures, but, you know, there has been, in some occasions, people who have done particularly well in SNP HQ have been chosen over local candidates. And OK, I'll quite grant you some, you know, being local isn't the be all and end all. You know, you sometimes don't have strong enough people to be able to take the flak that comes with being a candidate. So but still, I mean, that's an interesting thing because it means you've got some real expertise kind of coming back in to the parliament with candidates like that. So there's definitely reasons to be cheerful. And so many of the people who've come in have actually, in Jim's case, actually increased the majority Rosanna Cunningham had, which is blooming amazing because you'd expect when a big hitter goes that there's a bit of a dunt. So I know there's a lot of people being jaundiced about a lot of things in the background, but as ever, I just refuse to be
No, I mean,
Doncaster, I'm glad you're not either.
I'm surprisingly cheery. I mean, I think that may be the paracetamol, the brufen kicking in. But genuinely, it was good to see. And Mark Ruskell got back in here in Northeast Fife, and that was an excellent result for the Greens. But it's that imposition of parliamentary candidates. If we can, we can move on to, let's take a look at the by-election in Hartlepool, which was being trumpeted as this amazing triumph for the Conservative Party in a red wall. We've got the blue belt in the south of Scotland, we've got the red wall, so Hartlepool. And we compare and contrast there. The turnout in Hartlepool for that by-election was 47%. Mm-hmm. You know, 53% of the people eligible to vote didn't, are so alienated or can't be bothered, didn't turn out to vote. And what happened there was that Keir Starmer, Paris Williams, who'd been an MP for another area closely right hard by Hartlepool, and was a guy who'd actually been part of a consultation process and a paper that was produced, which was talking about closing down local hospital facilities and local hospitals, you know, closing them down, and then suddenly it turns up as a defender. They only had one day candidates to put in their candidacy for the Labour Party. So it was a complete stitch up. And what you also have is Ben Houchin, who's the mayor for the Tees Valley area. And this should be a warning to everybody what's coming down the road, because the Tories operate in fundamentally an ideology-free zone. They will do and say anything to be elected. So have this Ben Houchin is Conservative, and they've got the Freeport in the Teesside area. But what they've also done is taken Teesside Airport into public ownership. So they can, what? They've nationalised. So you've got these two things going on simultaneously. And what they're doing is fundamentally pork barrel politics. What does that mean for Scotland? Well, I think this is a model that Johnson might follow. We've got the Shared Prosperity Fund, the replacement for the EU Structural Fund, in which the Boris Johnson's government can actually parachute money into places like the Blue Belt and Aberdeenshire, you know, target these Tory SNP marginals, pump that money in, going over the heads of the Scottish government, and do what they did in Hartlepool, which is make sure, try and get in there, and we will do anything we possibly can to win an election. We'll throw money at you. Ideology, schmideology, we'll do what it takes. And with that Shared Prosperity Fund, the Internal Market Bill, that's the ability that the Conservatives have. And we can see what's coming down the line there. If you take a look at a working class community, which is 70% Leave vote, that's the difference, the split that's taking place. And when someone says to me, well, I've got more in common with a working class person in Hartlepool than I do with a Scottish landowner, well, you know, I might not these days. You know, mm-hmm. I might just have a, you know, and I'm not in favour of Scottish landowners in the main, but looking at what the way people in Hartlepool and the Red Wall are voting, not folk in London or Manchester, because Andy Burnham returned with an amazing majority, mm-hmm. a guy who stood up to the Conservative Party, unlike Keir Starmer, a guy who actually stood up in terms of localism and showed the strength of a metropolitan mayor, returned with a massive majority. So, but what's coming down the line? I said, that's what I can see. And that use of the Shared Prosperity Fund will be the tactic I think they will use to do it.
Very likely. You know, the thing that many commentators who are closer to Boris Johnson than either of us would ever wish to be have noticed that the one thing about him is he has no staying power on any of his big ideas. And for example, on this levelling up, which is the big, you know, the great hope, and has worked clearly, to some degree in some of the mayoral elections that have been first up and then massive, you know, very, very considerably overblown. Well, mm-hmm. you know, they're significant, but you stand back and you look at the Queen of Councils, Labour still retained, and you know, it's a bad scene for Labour. There's no two ways about it. But yes, well, you know, he's been trumpeting on about this levelling up idea for, I don't know, is it 2 years? But, you know, since mm-hmm. his election anyway, December 2019. And yet he has just appointed an advisor on levelling up last week.
Yeah.
So, you know, people are sort of saying there's, you know, and so we've had the union unit It was there, it was not there. It was there, it was not there. And it changes, you know, every week. Apparently, to his nearest and dearest within Downing Street, Boris is known as the trolley, on the basis that you start off trying to go in one direction and then it has a mind of its own and it's away off in the corner, and you can't basically direct it anywhere. So, you know, in theory, this is all possible, and there's no point being naive about it. If some of these kind of Freeport ideas are dangled, there's definitely areas that feel they're desperate enough that they will think, you know, this looks like the only game in town. And it will certainly put the, you know, the Scottish government on its mettle to come in and try and do something. I think we semi-discussed this before, because worryingly, the Scottish government has talked about trying to make sure these are sort of green free ports, which I think the Greens will be extremely not very happy with. But it's certainly going to mean that sort of ideas of infrastructure investment, albeit that the Scottish government and parliament has got so limited powers to do a lot of these things, there's going to have to be some sort of reaction. But I'm still very struck by how much people are deeply ungrateful for bungs. You know, when it comes to Brexit itself is a demonstration of that, because the parts of the UK that benefited most from, you know, Objective One funding from the EU cheerfully voted for Brexit. And there's a long track record around the world of people thinking that, you know, basically bribing local electors and the pork barrel stuff will work. And in some places it clearly does. And the Ben Hutchin kind of thing looks like people have decided this guy's got, I mean, let's face it, half the universe seems to have Boris Johnson's mobile phone number. But, you know, he's clearly got an inside track such that it gets lifted. So if you're stuck with these people forever, and that's the point of all of this, England is now stuck with the Conservatives for this, for, you know, for a decade. If that's the size of it, you better cozy up, because what's the point? What's the point in sitting railing, you know, from the outside with a Labour Party that's led by someone who just doesn't feel instinctively like he's sort of even on your side? If you're stuck, you know, betwixt and between, you might as well go for a guy who sounds like he's got, you know, he's got a line into the head honcho.
Yeah.
And sometimes in my deepest fucking weird moments, possibly, I've been pondering mightily the role of authenticity and accent lately, specifically as relates to Line of Duty and Adrian Dunbar's character and the way that every phrase he's got, Mother of God, finds its way into, you know, huge retweeting, and everyone just loves it. They love him because he sounds like a guy who has come from, you know, he's come up the ranks and he hasn't lost his accent. He's taken where he came from with him in his speech. Now, this is probably a stretch too far, but sometimes for a lot of English people, I think they think the same about Boris. That, like him or loathe him, at least you know where he came from, because he's not hiding it. No. All that florid blooming, right, that really kind of drives us crazy, seems to be a sort of authenticity of a kind to you know, a lot of English voters now. Yeah. You look at Keir Starmer, and he seems to be placeless. You know, you can't sort of put him anywhere. And I know that sounds really a bit superficial, when the deeper things about, you know, the policy commitments and the kind of chucking, well, as we're doubtless about to come on to, chucking Angela Rayner sort of under the bus already, deputy leader and chair, campaign leader and so on. And as Owen Jones has just gone on and tweeted, you know, Keir Starmer chucking working class women under the bus for his own mistakes, you know. You can tell where Angela Rayner's coming from. You just can't sort of tell where Keir Starmer's coming from. And maybe the same could have been said about Tony Blair, still, you know, rated as the great sort of, you know, white hope of Labour. But there's something at the moment that some sort of authenticity pays you a lot in politics. And I think Nicola Sturgeon also has an authenticity. She sounds like she comes from where she comes from, you know. And when she was actually, that kind of wee exchange that she had with the right wing BAM was also a great proof of that, because she was enough of a Glasgow BAM herself to think, you're not going to push me around, honey. And she stood her ground. You know, she didn't scutter off a la Subway, you know, Ian Gray, unfortunate moment from which he never recovered. So, yeah, there's an authenticity problem, which also sort of feeds its way through to what are his political roots?
Yeah.
You know, you feel you just don't know in so many respects. So there's massive problems, clearly, for Labour. And now they are definitely imploding, whether or not that was necessary in response to these mayoral elections. I don't know. But, you know, clearly there's just been a very thin tin lid kept on all the divisions there have been since Jeremy Corbyn went. And I saw that Channel 4 News had a cheeky little interview with Jeremy Corbyn, which was actually really interesting because he was on it. He was together. He was very coherent. And, you know, and he wasn't exact. And he wasn't being sort of smug. You know, he could so easily have said, here's all the stuff that was in our manifesto. Here's the things that people are now, you know, have now done. The Tories have done half of it. So perhaps everybody could have just saved themselves a lot of grief and believed in it, you know?
Yeah. Well, the other aspect of it is that neither you nor I, despite what certain people say, take any delight in seeing Labour go down the pan in England at all. Mm. I despise what's happening. And this is a trope for this for me in this podcast. Preston, however, Labour retained all its councillors, 30 councillors. There were 10 up for re-election because they don't do everybody at the same time. Don't get me started on the first past the post system and how they organise their local elections down there. But all 10 Preston Council Labour councillors were re-elected. And remember, that's the progressive, left of centre, cooperative-based, you know, encouraged trade unions, very, very different, standing out in Northern England. And they... incredible success, and it's been retweeted constantly now. The fact is that if that's what Preston Labour could do, why will Keir Starmer not go near it? He is second guessing himself constantly. I don't think the man knows what he believes in. I genuinely don't. He believes in getting Labour elected, yeah, but to do what, Keir? To do what? As I say, ditching Angela Rayner, throwing a woman under a working class woman under a bus, you know, because she's party chair and campaign coordinator. And yeah. Peter Mandelson coming out and saying it's all Corbyn's fault. I mean, for, yeah, you know.
Yeah, it's so lazy play it again, Sam. You know, it's dreadful. But I mean, also, when you're talking about Andy Burnham, I noticed that King of the North started trending again, you know, because it's almost people want to like him, you know.
Yes.
But in his acceptance speech, he was basically saying Labour has got to accept that a metropolitan southern leadership that doesn't get the North is completely unacceptable and the party will fail.
Mm. It's so, what the North, you know, believes, though, or what the narrative the North has been sold that actually worries me, and what the undercurrents are and why so many of these areas, which were economically being supported by the European Union in terms of subsidies, voted so strongly. Yeah.
It's not a simple thing, but I think you could probably isolate pretty clearly what doesn't work. And having somebody who sounds extremely soft, southern and metropolitan, and just not that engaged. And let's remember back to previous things, you know, going back to the old nuts and bolts. You know, when the northern mayors were going out on a limb about furlough payments for their cities when they were put back into lockdown, they didn't get a lot of support. When they were supporting, along with the trade unions, they were stopping the nonsense, really, of going back to school prematurely, which they led. They didn't get support from Keir Starmer. So this, you know, he's been sitting on a fence with far more things. And I mean, this is only what has come to my attention. We're not sitting riveted on the domestic detail of English politics. But it looks like, you know, whenever there's a moment that kind of traditional working class organization is trying to protect its members in the North, you don't have Keir Starmer's automatic support. And you don't actually even get much of an innings with him, because I seem to remember Andy Burnham's complaint being that he actually couldn't get the attention of Keir Starmer at that moment of some emergency for people. So people don't forget that, you know, feeling of being abandoned. He should have got right up the road there. I mean, it just feels obvious now, but still. La-di-da.
Yeah, well, I'm going to... couple of things are going to finish on, one which is we'll do right at the end. But the thing I'm going to say is that I stayed attached to BBC Scotland's coverage, electoral coverage, and thoroughly enjoyed it. Really did. What I thought was remarkable were the number of very bright women reporters that they had, and it seemed a terrific number of very bright women who were out on location giving reports back from the counts, and in particular two professors from both from the University of Edinburgh, my alma mater, Professor Nicola McEwen and Professor Ailsa Henderson, who are absolutely fantastic in terms of their insights and well worth looking at. I thought Martin Geisler was terrific as well. The fact that he turns out to be a Dundee United supporter, and we'll gloss over my personal disappointments today, but I thought he held it together very well. Didn't display any of the... Yeah, he was funny, he was self-deprecatory, and I think it worked tremendously well. I found it illuminating, I found the whole thing, other than the rather bizarre thing of explaining the haunt system the day after, you know, everybody had voted and how it worked. I thought, wait a minute, what's the possible point of this? But no, I thought particularly the two professors were absolutely excellent and incredibly illuminating, and just were spot on in terms of their analysis, in terms of their genuine neutrality and their ability to actually come straight to the point and make the factual points that were doing, delving into the data and the research that they were done. Absolutely super. So highly commended. And that may just be the lateness of night talking, but no, I felt that throughout the day. The other thing is, we're going to say happy birthday to someone.
Oh, yes. Gosh, we did say we were going to do this. In fact, we said we were going to sing it.
Yes, I don't know if that's it. Yes.
We haven't planned this at all, actually. No, this could be really dreadful.
Are we going to do this?
Oh, yes, of course we are. Right.
Now, shall we give him, we'll call him Coach or give him his proper name?
No, it won't rhyme properly, so let's call him Fraser.
Right. So, one, two, three.
Happy birthday to you, dear Fraser.
Because good old Fraser, our coach, spent his birthday as an election agent for the SNP.
So it wasn't just any birthday, it was his 40th birthday.
That's right, of course. Because I'm looking forward to seeing Fraser, so you can, I don't know if there's a tradition anywhere else, so I can give him his dumps.
Oh, the dumps. Oh, well, we used to call them the dumps, but yes, absolutely. Are you single-handedly going to do that?
Oh, I'll do the dumps. I've been out there keeping fit, doing my 10,000 steps a day, so I'll give me these dumps. Well, that's us come to the end of it.
We should, as ever, thank people for subscribing. And say that we're actually going to be interviewing Professor Mark Blythe tomorrow from Brown University. You might have heard of him. He had a tremendous performance on another podcast that David McWilliams, an equally out there and frisky Irish economic political commentator, does a podcast, and he was on it. A lot of people have said, gosh, it'd be great to have him. The two of them were tremendously, of course, Scotland can be independent. I think when you try and look, as we will do, in more depth at his ideas, he wrote a very brilliant book, Angrynomics.
Yes.
So I think we will actually discover some unpleasant or uncomfortable truths, as well as trying to get him to rehearse his views about Scottish independence. So anyway, that will be one of our extra podcasts that goes to our pals and buddies, because we're very conscious that we're so grateful to you, and we will keep producing the needful. And I've also seen a couple of people asking, we'd mentioned that we would do little Q&A sessions at some point, and now that the election is over, and it's only when it's over that you realise, I know it's occupied, you know, obviously every candidate's waking moments, and then folk like the coach who are kind of the backroom staff, but it's been the same for us, you know, it's like a huge, like life begins again after tomorrow a bit, you know, in a new direction. So I think we will all feel a little bit more energy, and we can turn our minds a little bit to what's next.
And what's next is that I will get to work and put this up as the podcast. And take care, chums, and we'll see you next week.